Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. The first question of the day is, where does America turn for food assistance? In 2019, some 35 million Americans worried about a low-quality diet or when they would get their next meal. Over the past year, the pandemic has multiplied the number of people who face food insecurity in some way. Yet the United States produces more than enough food for everyone. And this raises the question about why the problem is so persistent and what can be done to address it. You wonder, why are so many people food insecure? Food insecurity is a complex problem, although it's often intricately linked to poverty. They are really two different things. Some people living above the poverty line are food insecure due to high expenses that they have for housing and health care or transportation. On the other hand, there are also low-income people who have unusually low expenses and are not food insecure. Mapping between food security and poverty, that is where poverty here means low income, is imperfect because ultimately they're both getting at the core idea of what is people's quality of life. And if you think about what defines someone's quality of life, well, it's defined by a lot of different things. The pandemic has thrown many more Americans into precarious situations as work opportunities and access to support networks have been reduced. As the unemployment rate surged to almost 15% in April last year, demand at food banks also jumped across the country. A Pew Research Center survey found that about 17% of Americans have gotten food from a food bank. Black and Hispanic adults were three times more likely to have gone to a food bank compared with white adults. Researchers at Northwestern University estimate that food insecurity more than doubled during the pandemic, affecting up to 23% of all households. Although unemployment has diminished since last spring, census surveys continue to show high levels of food insecurity. Just what is being done to help? In the U.S., three federal nutrition assistance programs are trying to address the issue. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, called SNAP, the National School Lunch Program, and the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, called WIC, W-I-C. According to the USDA, 58% of food insecure households participated in one or more of the three federal programs in the month prior to December 2019. SNAP, which used to be known as the Food Stamp Program, is the largest nutrition assistance program for low-income Americans. Eligible households receive an electronic benefit transfer card that they can use to buy food. How has the pandemic affected response? Well, at the federal level, emergency policies were put into place, such as increased funding for SNAP and allowing the benefits to be used for online grocery shopping. Other incentives include the Farmers to Families Food Box Program, that is, to purchase and distribute agricultural products to the food banks and to nonprofits, and the Pandemic Electronic Benefit Transfer, PEBT, which provides families with vouchers to purchase groceries to replace lost school meals when the schools have been closed. The pandemic has also prompted the private sector, nonprofits, and individuals to rethink approaches to these challenges. And there is potential for some of these changes that have been made to stay in place beyond the pandemic. There's been a huge enhancement of awareness around the private food assistance systems. It's really awakened people to how close many of our neighbors are to the margin. And that heightened awareness has boosted giving. Many in the food bank and food pantry system have seen an increase in donations and more people wanting to volunteer. You may have wondered what being a fluent speaker of another language means. Well, the columnist Melissa Moore, who writes for the Christian Science Monitor Weekly, has a column in which she addresses that topic. Her daughter asked recently whether or not she thought that she was fluent in French. But this was a difficult question to answer. She's in her fourth year of studying the language in high school, and she can do in French many of the things she enjoys in English. Listen to pop music or watch Netflix shows, look at social media. But she doesn't know the French equivalents of, say, scapegoat or mundane. And her accent would never be mistaken for Parisian. So what does it mean to speak a language fluently? And her mother, the columnist, did some research on this, and this is what she has replied to that question from her daughter. She said, "Before I researched this column, I would have said that true fluency was hard to achieve in a language that a person hadn't grown up speaking. I imagine that you could call yourself fluent in French only if you could pass yourself off as a native speaker, like the protagonist in a spy thriller." Many Americans share this view. According to journalist Eva Sandoval, who speaks English and Italian, and she says, in lay circles, this term has come to equal native level proficient. Perhaps Americans have such high expectations for fluency because 80% of us speak only English. Polyglots, on the other hand, who speak multiple languages, and hyper-polyglots, who speak upwards of 11, think about it differently. A hyper-polyglot, argues Richard Simcott, is what no one who masters all of the nuances of a language. It's really a false standard. A better measurement of fluency evaluates it along a spectrum, taking into account context and the language learner's goals, rate and smoothness of speech, how long speakers pause to find words, and how often they make and correct errors, are important in assessing proficiency. As the word fluent, which is from the Latin fluere, to flow, suggests, grammatical accuracy and range of vocabulary are key elements as well. Perhaps the best known standard of measurement now is the Common European Framework of Reference for Languages, which has been adopted around the world. It describes six levels of proficiency, from A1, can interact in a simple way, provided the other person talks slowly and clearly and is prepared to help, to C2, can understand with ease virtually everything heard or read. Many countries use this scale to judge whether language learners are adept enough to study at a university or to be granted a work visa. And surely the ability to take college courses or conduct business in another language counts as being fluent. Fortunately for aspiring polyglots, this level is often not the formidable C2 level, but rather the more approachable B2 level, which involves enough familiarity and confidence in writing and speaking to handle everyday communications at both work and school. Well, Melissa's daughter will probably never pass the spy test, but she can tell her that she is fluent in French, and she'll be happy about that, I think. Let's look at some improvement to the environment around the world. In the United States, in French Polynesia, and in Mexico. Oddly enough, all of the subjects, or I should say each of the subjects in all of these places, begins with a P. First, we'll talk about porpoises, then about pearls, and finally, plastics. In the United States, harbor porpoises have made a comeback after the banning of gulf netting in key coastal communities of California, according to the latest research. Gill nets are a cheap and effective way for commercial fishers to catch loads of sea bass and halibut by the gills, but they also wreak havoc on other species, including sea otters, some seabirds, and the lesser-known harbor porpoise. The latter exclusively lives in shallow waters, being unable to detect the nylon mesh using echolocation. The porpoises would frequently drown after getting tangled in gill nets. And so things are looking better for our porpoises. And now let's go down to French Polynesia in the southern hemisphere, where we see that some pearl producers in French Polynesia are using more sustainable practices, helping safeguard the island's resources and serving as a role model for other farms. Islands like those of French Polynesia are highly vulnerable to rising sea levels, and quality pearl farming relies on healthy oceans The pearl industry is second largest economic driver of French Polynesia after tourism, and small businesses such as Komoka Pearl Farm are pioneering environmentally friendly methods. Instead of power washing algae off of oysters, which sprays debris into the ocean, Komoka lets the lagoon's native fish clean its mollusks. And as a result, fish populations around the island are thriving. And then to Mexico. Mexico City's ban on most single-use plastics came into effect in January after more than a year of preparation. In 2020, Mexico City's environmental agency said that the capital produced roughly 13,000 tons of garbage per day, including more than 7 million tons of plastic over the course of a year. I personally have seen the number of garbage dumps that are on the outskirts of Mexico City when I was doing research in that area. Single-use plastic bags were finally banned in 2020. And now, the commercialization, the distribution, and the delivery of other plastic products, including straws, disposable plastic cups, and balloons, is finally prohibited. During the first months of the ban, the focus will be on informing people. No fines will be imposed on violators. But with the lack of strict enforcement and the ongoing coronavirus crisis, change on the plastics front is expected to be slow. And now I want to tell you about the return of the Bremen. You probably haven't heard this, but after a lifetime in exile, Hugo Junkers, record setter, crossed the ocean one last time. And what I'm referring to is flying across the Atlantic. Only this time, it was in the direction opposite to that Lindbergh flew. 11 months after Charles Lindbergh's solo Atlantic crossing in the custom-built Spirit of St. Louis, three men boarded a Junkers factory-made all-metal airplane called the Bremen, and despite fierce headwinds, fog, and sleet, became the first to fly across the ocean in the other direction. Teddy Finley, the biographer of the Bremen's Irish co-pilot, wrote that the flight was considered impossible by experts of the day, including Lindbergh. And although Lindbergh's trip from New York to Paris was actually the second nonstop eastward crossing, because 8 years earlier, after John Alcock and Arthur Brown made the first in an open cockpit Vimy plane that landed them in an Irish bog. And the Bremen's crew achieved a first. The Bremen did not win the lasting fame of the Spirit of St. Louis. Lindbergh's airplane became a centerpiece at the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum. Germany's premier science museum rejected the Bremen, and it bounced from one American museum to another until finally, 70 years later. After its historic flight, the Bremen made its way back across the Atlantic to its namesake city. The story of the Bremen proves again that finding a place in history depends as much on timing and social context as it does on virtuosity. When the Bremen rolled out of the Junkers Dessau plant in 1927, Hermann Kohl, the 39-year-old Lufthansa pilot who would fly it across the ocean, called it the greatest plane in existence. Its low-slung, 60-foot-long, cantilevered wings set it apart from the competition. The Spirit of St. Louis, you remember, and most other monoplanes of the day needed struts to brace the wings against aerodynamic stress, even though struts increased drag. With its modern wing and corrugated aluminum alloy shell, the Junkers W-33 was derived from the world-changing Junkers F-13, a four-passenger transport first flown in 1919. And within 5 years, the F-13 had become the dominant plane in world air traffic. Still, the political and economic instability of World War I Europe and Russia made Junkers seek even more passengers and in the United States. And while the Bremen was being built, the company's plant became a center for Hugo Junkers' Atlantic projects, part of his years-long flight to keep the company from being taken over by the German government. And despite his aeronautical triumphs, a decade of inflation in Germany had brought Junkers to insolvency. Taking advantage of its financial vulnerability, Germany's aviation ministries forcibly merged part of his company in 1926 with its chief competitor to create the nationalized airline Deutsche Lufthansa, or Lufthansa that we know today. For some men, degrees, but no jobs. The relationship between men and advanced education seems to be fraying, according to Bloomberg Businessweek. It's often been said that the more education you have, the more likely you are to have a job. However, in last month's U.S. labor report, 74% of men 25 and older with only a bachelor's degree were employed, compared to 73% of men with advanced degrees. This seeming inversion has been present in labor data for all but 5 months over the past years. The reasons for this are not clear yet. Men with advanced degrees earn a median of $136,000 a year, far more than the average of $71,000 for men with a bachelor's degree. So it is possible that highly credentialed male labor force dropouts have just gotten rich and retired early. But the same pattern does not exist for well-educated women. So, this deserves more digging and research. Keep that in mind, and we'll be back with it another time. And then a few words about Social Security benefits. Next year's Social Security benefits are expected to jump by the largest amount since 2012. I hear you all clapping out there. According to our calculation in the Kiplinger report, the cost of living adjustment, COLA, should be 3% in January of 2022, up from the increase of 1.3% this year. COLAs are calculated using an index that's similar to the one used to calculate inflation. Last year's COLA increase was the smallest since 2017. And so, for today, this is Dan Dillman, your host, signing off for a little of this, a little of that. Please come back, because I'll be waiting for you right here, 101.5 FM on your dial. Goodbye.